Well, no, I'm not sure exactly what we're supposed to do here, excepting that, it's an opportunity to kind of round out the conference and see how people react and what they feel the conclusions are, but also to bring up perhaps a few additional points that you feel need to be clarified or added. I think all the people here at the table, just keep that in mind, say anything you feel would be useful at this point. And I would suggest we have about three or four people at the table say whatever they would like to say. Then we'll hesitate and see if the audience would like to pursue those particular things a little further, and then we'll go on down the line. Okay, well now let me see. Let's start down here at the end.
Okay.
Flesh.
I don't know how many people in the room are communicators. I know a lot of people are interested in detecting signals and searching the skies, and I think a lot of people come from astronomy backgrounds. But a lot of the discussion that I heard did not have the same language that most communicators tend to use all the time. And so I thought perhaps I might be able to add something from a communication flavor, just to try to give you a different perspective of things. JPL has for years sent spacecraft out and tried very, very hard to communicate data back. Now this is an intentional communication where they were trying to send data back from deep space. And of course that's a tough job to do. And what we find is that as time goes on, the frequencies have continued to increase. And the aperture sizes have continued to increase. In other words, the directivity of sending that information back has been on the rise all along since we started. To just kind of show where this can go, this is one of the slides that I use in an optical communications presentation, and it just shows the benefit of going to optical from a real practical standpoint. What I'm showing here is the Voyager spacecraft with its RF X-band antenna transmitting back from Saturn, and it produces about 1,000 Earth diameter beam width by the time it gets back to the Earth over 10 AU. That's with a 3.7 meter antenna. And instead, if you take a telescope about that big at optical and transmit it back, then you get about one Earth diameter. And that's why we're actually developing the technology for such systems. I heard talk about 10 meter systems. Sometimes they were referred to as Keck telescopes, but in fact we have in the plan right now the construction of a large 10 meter photon bucket system, and this would have very much worse quality for the surface quality of the aperture than the Keck telescope. And the whole purpose is to drive costs down. You don't need to preserve phase across the aperture if what you're trying to do is to detect very weak photon pulses coming back. We also have some work in narrowband filters to get rid of a lot of the background noise that you have to contend with, whether that background comes from our sun or somebody else's sun. And this, for example, is a Faraday rotation filter that I'll just summarize, has a bandwidth that can be selected out. It's about 1 gigahertz wide. And it has quite high throughput, projections as high as 80% total throughput efficiency of that particular filter. So the technologies are coming along for that. I'd also like to say that I think in some of the modeling of what is being done, there are some concerns that I have. And those concerns stem around two things. One is the fact that if you take a look, I hear a lot of people talking about quantum noise, things like that. And I think that there are some misconceptions that I'd like to have you at least think about. If we take a signal, an optical signal, we turn it on, a beam, a laser, a CW laser, let's say, and if we have a fairly high intensity, then because of the quantum nature of that signal, you will actually see a fluctuation. We call that quantum noise. And typically what happens is people say, well, gee, that's roughly the square root of the intensity, and so we can calculate a signal-to-noise ratio. In other words, there's a mean signal, and there's a fluctuation that we call noise. And so a lot of people use that signal-to-noise ratio as one of their characteristic parameters of interest. And in fact, there are other scenarios. And another scenario is that we are sending back, in a fairly background or noise-free environment, a series of pulses. And those pulses are intentionally sent back, but by the time they get to the target, they're fairly weak. And the number of photons in there is fairly small. So I'm showing here an average intensity of, let's say, 2 photons per pulse. Now, if you choose to look at this signal as being a mean level with a quantum fluctuation around it, that's your choice. But I can tell you that from the standpoint of a communication system, that's not the right way of looking at it. In fact, the primary way that this system in a communication system makes errors is because occasionally when you send a pulse that may have an average intensity of 2 photons, actually quantum fluctuations result in 0 photons getting to the receiver. And that's called an erasure, and the probability of that event occurring is e to the minus lambda, which is the intensity of the signal. So I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that when you compute communication performance, or if you're talking about signal detection performance in the communication sense, that SNRs can be extremely misleading. That the detection statistics depend on the intensity of the signal and on the intensity of the noise or the background that you deal with, not just the ratio of those two. So it's important to be aware.
Could you explain that e to the minus lambda? What are you talking about there?
E to the minus lambda is simply saying if I have a Poisson distribution of 2 or any number lambda,
yeah,
then the probability that the number of photons that I receive is 0,
sure,
is given by e to the minus lambda, and that is the erasure.
Well, lambda is the mean?
Lambda is the mean.
Lambda is the
mean
value.
Okay.
That's right. Now, to kind of put things in perspective, a lot of people talk about the quantum limit of communication. And if you take a look at somebody like Uribe's book, and he talks about coherent detection of signals, of optical signals, he then works out what happens if you turn the local oscillator up to infinity or almost there, and you get to the point to where you wipe out all the thermal noise in the detector and you get quantum limited performance. It sounds wonderful. 10 years ago at JPL, we demonstrated a system in the laboratory that could transmit over 2.5 bits of information per detected photon at the receiver. Now, let me remind you that if you calculate the quantum limit for a heterodyne system, it's 1.4 bits per detected photon. So that's the ultimate limit that no system can exceed, and yet in the laboratory with a direct detection system, we demonstrated something that was about twice that good. And the reason is that the quantum limit is based on that earlier noise model that I showed on the previous view graph, where you have a mean signal and a fluctuation. And there are certain models for the noise and certain models for the detection statistics that you have to be very, very concerned about as to whether or not they still apply. And in some of these weak signal transmission systems, they do not apply. And in fact, we proved it. Now, how conceptually can you do that? Some people think it's not possible to do it. And so I just show it with this quick view graph. If I take a time interval, shown right here, and divide it up into a number of little time slots, and if I put one pulse in one of those time slots, then basically I'm saying it's the third message out of 8. So I have sent you now 3 bits of information because there are 8 choices and I can represent 8 by 3 bits of information. If I take that same pulse and transmit it over a link and it gets diluted, and I'm showing it right here, and if that pulse has 3 photons in it on the average, then the average throughput of that system is 3 bits of information or 3 photons detected at the receiver. In our demonstration, we did not have 8 bins, but we had 256 bins. In other words, 8 bits of information transmitted, and we did have an average intensity of 3 photons at the receiver. So it is, we don't violate any of the fundamental physical principles. We just utilize the fact that the statistics aren't the same kind of statistics as in some of the other arenas. So my point of all of this is to just caution you that it's important to not look at signal-to-noise ratios. It's important to say if you have certain kinds of signals coming back, what are the best ways of detecting them? And I think that that may apply to not only the optical versions, but also the RF as well.
Can I comment on that? You're capitalizing on the fact that you didn't have any photons in those other slots.
That's correct.
Not getting something for nothing, that's part of the statistics that you're dealing with.
if you start adding noise photons in there, yes, it does deteriorate.
You hear a lot.
That goes down.
Yeah.
Not necessarily lost, because you have to actually know then what is that intensity.
I wanted to ask another question about this photon bucket. You stated, it seemed to me you oversold it a little bit. If you have lost phase information because of a poor surface, another way of stating that is that you're going to get a larger image of a point source out here. It's going to be spread out over an area. And if you have a sensitive detector over that entire area, you're going to be receiving photons all over that detector. Various points on the detector could correspond to different beams out here. So what you're saying is you've got a very poor directivity pattern that you'd have than if it were a good optical surface.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That is correct.
So it works in a dark field, but not in a bright field.
As I had mentioned earlier this morning, a comment to Dr. Towns' presentation, yes, there is a trade-off between how imperfect you make that aperture versus how many spatial directions you become subject to background noise.
Right.
And yes,
noise from all those other directions, if there is noise.
If there is noise in there.
Right.
If you have stellar images that are point sources and not many other images in the vicinity, then what you do is you have a wider field of view viewing that that noise source, the star in this particular case. But if it's a distributed source, then yes, you will automatically increase the noise based on that ratio of the field of view. If it is a point source or a not very well distributed source, then there's a limit of how much additional noise you pick up because of that wider field of view.
Yeah, let me just comment on this question of signal noise. If you were to cut your signal off, then there's no noise. If you cut off your signal, there's no noise. And the way I would define signal and noise on the basis of the strength of the signal compared with the noise that's there when there is no signal. In that case, then this comes out as normal signal noise, and just the way you're describing it. It's a matter of language is what you call signal noise. And I think it would be handy and a little more logical to say, well, the noise is what's there without the signal. But no signal at all.
Yeah.
In that case,
noise,
then the noise can be essentially zero.
And my caution is beware of simply taking the ratio of those two parameters, however you define the noise. Because the actual performance of a detection system depends on the particular operating point as well as the ratio of those two values.
Well, I would say if there were no noise at all, no photons there at all, and one photon comes along, which is your signal, and you detect it, you've got a very high signal noise.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you define the signal noise the way I would define it, then I think there's no more worry about it. I think it comes out right.
I think that there are a lot of people that would agree with you. I think that there are people who would likewise disagree with you because of the quantum noise that you typically get through fluctuation when the intensity is large. But my point is that it is not just a function that depends on the ratio. It's a function that depends on the individual operating points for both whatever you define as noise as well as what you define as signal.
I think what you're defining as noise, I would define as signal fluctuations. Fluctuations in signal instead. Yeah. Okay.
I was just going to say, it seems to me that the issue here is one of detection versus decoding. I tend to side with Professor Towns here. You know, I want to know about my detection signal-to-noise ratio because of my special interests. If, on the other hand, I'm trying to communicate, what a signal-to-noise ratio is has to tell me how well I can, in fact, get my message back. And I think these are often different issues. Certainly in the microwave region, the statistics of detection and decoding look very different.
In your critique of the models underlying traditional approach, are you producing an argument for what enhanced detection possibilities, or are you actually? I'm not even sure if I've got the direction of criticism right here.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a gloomier outcome that we're looking at based on what you're saying, or is it a more optimistic picture? It sounds to me like a more optimistic.
In many cases, I think it will turn out to be a more optimistic situation, and you did state it correctly. It is ways of enhancing the detectability of the pulse that I'm trying to refer to. Okay, in order to communicate, we typically have to detect those pulses. We then try to extract from that some information through the modulation format. Now, what I'm talking about is in order to do the best job of communicating and getting that information, we also have to do the best job of detecting. And it's from that standpoint that I was bringing up these various models.
All right, well, I'd like to move along now, and we'll go another couple of notches, and then we'll allow further discussion, because some of these same issues may well come up again. Okay, would you like to make any comments?
The only comment I would like to make, since I was speaking so much about very short pulses, that I didn't intend to mean in my presentation that somehow there's something magic about 1 nanosecond. All I meant to intend was that it's in that arena of short pulses that you gain this bits per pulse very readily, and that you gain this potential discrimination against the background, against the star's background. And there's nothing magic about the 1 nanosecond, just like there's no magic frequency. It's just a convenient parameter when one goes through the numbers.
What do you mean by short? Short compared to what?
Right, short, that's it. Short, 1 nanosecond comes out to be a value that for a given reasonable spectral filter width, the background, star background photoelectrons are quite low. They're in the range of 1 or less per nanosecond, which means you got to have a certain number, as Jim was just talking about, you have to have a certain number of signal photoelectrons anyway, so you want to get the background down to a level below that to compare with. And so you want to choose your values, just from a system engineering viewpoint, you want to choose your values to allow not to lose information or detectability because of the star's background. But you don't want to go any further than that because of other system parameters, such as longer search times and things of that sort. So that's how 1 nanosecond came about. There may be some better times, but short pulses are still good. They're just like chicken soup.
Okay. Thank you. Would you like to make some comments?
I'm not a scientist. I'm a philosopher, and so this contribution may be very different from the other two. I've been very interested in this session, listening to scientists talk to one another at such high levels of technical expertise and getting a feel for how detailed the debate is. But at the same time, I've been quite distinctly impressed by how they're being party to common assumptions. In some crucial cases, seems to leave certain assumptions is still covered, you know, not brought out explicitly and not examined to see whether they really are conditioning the whole discourse. And I've been reading a few more papers in this area, and time and again I come across this assumption that communication is possible just as soon as you detect a signal, that you can interpret what may be said, that you would be able to tell an alien civilization by responding to them appropriately with a message that has a content that has to be agreed on by international protocol. And it's all these philosophically loaded notions that I want to draw to your attention as scientists, because I think you move too easily from the realm of discourse of the Shannon-Weaver theory of communication and bits per second and so on, to the area of semantically structured and semantically laden messages. And it's a very important juncture in the collaboration between scientists and philosophers. I'm reminded of two past episodes in the history of thought and intellectual endeavor generally. First, there was the foundations of mathematics, when mathematicians and logicians, in a philosophical way, first started examining the very limits of the axiomatic and deductive method. There was a widespread assumption at the beginning of this century that all the truths about certain mathematical structures could be deduced formalistically from certain specified axioms that were clearly true about those structures. And in a revolutionary piece of conceptual analysis, Kurt Gödel showed the incompletability of formal arithmetic. So there was a mathematician doing a piece of conceptual work that showed that arithmetical truth outstripped what could be done in principle by any machine. This then led, because of the methods employed, into further investigations into the notion of mechanically computable function. Once again, there was a prevailing dogma to the effect that virtually anything could be done by a machine, so long as it was combinatorially specified and so on. But then the diagonal methods involved in Gödel's proof allowed him to show that there were certain things that machines could not do, solving the halting problem, for example, about machines themselves. All I'm suggesting is that the time may be ripe within the SETI community for a philosophical fronting up to some of the underlying issues about communication, about decodability, about contact and content. And I would like to suggest that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, with the sibilant S at the beginning, may be a starter in that you can go for detection. But when you start talking about communication with extraterrestrial intelligences, with a hard C, KETI, then you are way out of left field, as far as most of my philosophical colleagues would see you.
All right, well, let's see. Let's hesitate here now and comment on any of the last three speakers. Anyone want to add something? Did you have, you had an earlier question, I think.
I was only going to comment about the definition of signal-to-noise ratio. And it seems that in the systems I have dealt with that noise usually encompasses both the background and the signal fluctuation. And in some situations, the background dominates, and in other situations, it's the signal fluctuation that dominates. But a good definition of noise, I think, should include both types of fluctuations.
Any other comments? Anyone solve the question of how we communicate? Oh, okay. Was someone here going to speak? Anyone solve the question of how we communicate? I've heard solutions to how we decide whether the signal is from an intelligent group, but what it says, I have never heard a solution to. There's somebody back here.
Trying to communicate with other intelligent beings, we have to ask ourselves, is it the engineers that are going to motivate it, or is it the politicians of the other life forms that are going to motivate it? And if it's the politicians of the other life forms that are going to motivate the communication, since the assumption is that they're in control of the resources as opposed to the technology, then the question is, what is their motivation? And if their motivation is to interrogate as opposed to communicate, then it may be that they don't want us to know that we're being interrogated. If their motivation is to communicate, then it's as simple as, if they're visual beings, they would wave or make a noise or do something that would be bringing attention to them. The second type of, so that's one kind of communication, is sort of like a at the beginning of a protocol packet, there's a bunch of ones or zeros or ones and zeros that sort of is, you know, calling the meeting to order. But how many thousands of years are they going to do that? There'd be no communication in that. So that'd be one thing to look for in the communication. The second thing that we maybe could look at would be that there's ongoing communications where we're just listeners and they're already communicating with somebody else, in which case that they may be at a different subspace band that we are assuming that they're trying to reach us at certain windows of our capability that are far beyond the capability of where we are. So the chances of us being able to listen in on technology that's above us, I don't think they'd consider making it easy for us to listen in on communications that were going beyond us. So maybe it's a combination of both. Maybe we should be listening to these attention getters, which are headers of packets of communication with things that are behind it that change. So there'd be some modification, some repetitive signal with some modulation that changes behind it. Those are my thoughts on communication. Sort of, if somebody's rapping the table trying to get your attention, then they may follow that by some information.
Good. All right, let's proceed then, Dr. Kingsley.
I just wanted to, in fact, Professor Towns might be the best person here to answer this, to continue on the area that I mentioned this morning about interstellar dispersion and get us something a bit more definitive there. What do you believe are the limits in terms of bandwidth for transmission in the microwave regime if we've got the capability vis-a-vis optics? Assuming there's no limitation in signal noise ratio, just limitation in fundamental limitation in dispersion, interstellar dispersion.
Oh, you would worry about interstellar dispersion in the signal.
Yeah, in the signal, limiting your modulation rates, effective communication rates.
I'm afraid I've never put any numbers into that, but it would be fairly easy to calculate that the dispersion in the radio region be primarily given by the ionized material. And we know its behavior with wavelength, and we know roughly its density. It will depend a lot on the particular direction, but if we get relatively clean directions, then there'd be relatively little dispersion.
What do you call relatively little in terms of nanoseconds or what have you, over 1,000 light years?
Well, there are directions in which the attenuation is essentially is almost zero. I mean, the attenuation is zero. You know from the relation between real and imaginary parts that then the phase change would also be essentially negligible. So I think there are directions in which it would be very small. Other directions in which it would be
in the galactic plane.
In the galactic plane, yes. Right, even in the galactic plane. If we tried to communicate, let's say, across the galactic center or something like that, then we would be in trouble. But there would be quite a few regions where there'd be no great trouble, I believe. One could put numbers into that, but I think the fact that the attenuation is so small is means that the phase change would also be small.
Charlie?
Yeah, may I make a comment to that?
Yes.
It seems to me that dispersion is not a fundamental limit. If you want to be clever in your communications link, you can subdivide into whatever small band you like and put a synchronization signal in them so that the bits get all synced up right and you know you can overcome these problems in principle. I don't think that it's really reasonable to say that dispersion sets fundamental limits to communication systems even at microwave. I mean the obvious thing is that at a gigahertz you can't have 10 to the 14th hertz bandwidth.
Well, I think there's another aspect of this, the following, that if we know the attenuation between us and the place we're communicating with, and we can measure that simply by measuring the amount of radiation coming in our direction, in that case, because we also know the physical mechanism that's producing it, namely free-free transitions,
right.
We can then calculate dispersion, allow for it in our signal, and compensate for it.
Sure.
So it, there are some complications involved, but I don't think it's very fundamental. I agree.
Well, that presupposes a targeted.
That presupposes you know a targeted place, and you presupposes you know what the attenuation is between you and them, and that's not so easy. But it's one could make some approximation to it. I think it can cause a little trouble. I don't think it's a very serious problem for initial efforts, at least. You want to come in for the comments? Well, I guess that makes it my turn. One aspect One aspect that I would like to bring up is the following. I'm primarily working in astronomy now, and as I look at astronomy, there's so much interest and so much drive in just finding out things about stars and about planets and so on, that I would certainly expect within the next few decades that we will have we would have located the stars in our immediate vicinity, and by that I mean the kind of distance we're talking about, 100, 1,000 light years, which have substantial planets. Presently, systems are being planned which should be able to do that. They're tough, they're difficult, it's beyond what we have done yet, but nevertheless, I think they're practical. And so we will have located planets. Now the question, how much further could an intelligent community go? Would they be able to look at the planets and say, well, now this planet has this kind of an atmosphere and temperatures and so on? To what extent could they find out still more information and thereby be very selective in deciding which planets they would be interested in communicating with? I think there's a very substantial possibility there, and that will progress regardless of what SETI does. That information is likely to come in within the next few decades, a great deal of information, and that too will change the problem for us, and may well have changed the problem for a more advanced civilization, because they would know a great deal more, and they may pick out, let's say, one star in 1,000 that really looks interesting, and leave the rest of them alone. The other point I'd make at this time is several people have talked about and asked about this quantum noise, and I'm sure it's clear to some of you, but maybe not everyone, that quantum noise is necessary because of the uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle implies that you cannot measure both phase of a wave and the number of photons in a wave accurately at the same time. And this is why, if you use heterodyne detection, which is linear, it reproduces the phase of the wave to some extent, at least. Whenever you heterodyne detect, you have the possibility of measuring phase, and hence you automatically must introduce noise, and you introduce noise in the heterodyne process itself. So that gives you a noise, and typically for normal heterodyne detection, that's one quantum per unit bandwidth per second, which is a lot of noise as you get to high frequencies. In the radio range, it's negligible, relatively negligible. Now, the way around that is to use photon detection, where you simply let a photon generate an electron in solid, it's a photodiode, and you detect a quantum. You then know nothing at all about phase, and so there is no need to have any uncertainty whether there's a quantum there or not. And this is why, for the higher frequencies, the quantum detection is enormously better. You do not produce the noise in your detection the way linear detection or heterodyne detection would do. And hence, there's no reason, no necessary reason to have any background noise, and thereby you can detect single photons and even have very wide bandwidths, perhaps, if you can make the background sufficiently low, and the background of a distant star even is pretty low. You can blank out the star to a certain extent, so one can go a long distance in that direction. There is still, of course, the quantum fluctuations in the strength of the signal, which people have pointed out. That's there, but simply for detection itself, one can generate situations and do work which would then allow almost no background at all. And heterodyne is a great thing for radio astronomy, but it's very hazardous for the optical region.
But that noise on detection is important too, to some extent, isn't it, Charlie? I mean, if your expectation is much less than the photon per sampling time or per observation time, then that noise itself is high. There was nothing there,
Well, if you are looking for something and you don't find it 1 minute and 3 minutes later you find something, you say, okay, I've detected a signal.
Yes.
As long as you can,
three centuries, it's different.
Sure. Well, for three centuries in principle, if there's absolutely no background, you say, wait a minute, I've got something, I've got a photon.
Wow.
So you can integrate for a long time. In principle, you can integrate over very large bandwidth if the background really is sufficiently low. Now, I think let me go on to Fred. See, would you like to say something, and then we'll have general comments and questions.
I appreciate the opportunity to make some comments here on this. I'd like to address Drake's equation, the famous equation, and address the probability of solar systems being out in the galaxy. I think Drake was overly conservative. I think the statistics are completely different. Let me show you a bit of information. All astronomers know this particular curve, which shows you the rotation rate of stars as a function of spectral class. There's something, it's an S curve, with the F spectral class being in the middle and the GKM being at the very bottom. It's, the difference is two orders of magnitude. The O, A, and B type stars have a very high rotation rate relative to the GKM. Our sun is a G2. Question is, and it's a dilemma for the sun, how come the sun doesn't have the angular momentum? And the angular momentum is associated with the major planets. It's a dilemma that I'd like to address. I believe it's a surprise that I like you to be aware of, that we may not really understand the origin of the solar system. There may be completely a different model out here. And according to my thinking, I can reproduce Bode's law with a very simple model. Bode's law is the conservation of angular momentum, just given very simple assumptions. And being, if that's the case, I'm correct there. I may not be, but in the event that I'm correct, my interpretation, then all stars go through a certain evolutionary process. The O, A, and B are very young yet. They rotate very fast. Once they got the GK and M, they have lost the angular momentum because they have produced a solar system. So if this interpretation is correct, then 98% of the stars are GK and M in our galaxy. So the probability of having solar systems out there is very, very high. Now, the next question you might ask, well, would they have, I mentioned Bode's law, which gives you the relationships of the distances of the planets. If my model is correct, yes, you would have planets out there at those distances. Would there be one planet that is at the distance like the Earth? Yes, I think so. I think there ought to be at least one that is at the distance where you have liquid water. That's the basis for life. Mars is too far away and Venus is a little too close. So all you need is one just correct. Now, that changes the odds, I think, quite a bit for our discussions here. This would make it much more likely that there are planets out there. Now, another thing I'm going to say, which is not controversial, this is the controversial, this isn't. I mean, this is fact. But my theory is still not known nor accepted, so it's not very well known yet. However, I'd like you to consider this. The laws of physics are universal. Nobody ever questions them. Therefore, the laws of chemistry are universal. They're based on physics. Nobody ever challenges that either. Biology based on chemistry, well, there we don't know. We don't know what kind of biology we have out there because there are so many variables. The chances are that there is an enormous amount of chemistry in the galaxy. We now have a lot of evidence for this. The evidence from the interstellar medium, from the interstellar dust, shows, and some of the other molecules that are seen, at least 50 molecules of miniature type, but they all seem to have the signatures of organics in them. The evolution of molecules, planets, so strongly suggests that there is a system out there that is driven to produce possibility, at least the conditions for life are there. Whether there is any life, this is, of course, what the whole thing is all about, but at least the conditions, I think, are there. Nature is very prodigious. Remember, when animals breed, when the salmon breed, they produce a lot of eggs just to get a couple of salmon out of there. So I think nature might have done the very same thing. Things are overly abundant. The chances of perhaps, according to we being bombarded by, say, comets which have organics on them, often enough, many times, I think there is redundancy built in so that life might have started more than once, many more places. So I think we were kind of vain to think that we are alone is almost the same kind of as the Middle Ages. I hope I'm not treading on too many people's toes when I say this, but in the Middle Ages we thought we were in the middle of everything. Then it was a big shock when we found out that we are in the 1920s, that our sun is not in the middle of the galaxy, somewhere in the boondocks, and now we are considering that, well, we are not alone. And I think it's the time is ripe. The time is exceedingly ripe. Now, about messages, let me just make one controversial statement here. We do have messages from a long time ago. Let me just mention one that is unchanged that all of you are familiar with. We never thought about it as a message. The Bible was written at least 2,500 years ago, maybe 3,000 years. And this gets back to the comment that we talk about, can we read the messages? Are the messages in the Bible as written down the same as we read them today? The answer is no. I've now looked at it in detail. This is really another shock for you. There are at least half a dozen words in the Bible that we're not sure of its meaning. We lost the meaning from 2,500 years ago. And there's a whole sentence in there which may have double meanings, of which the double entendre is very subtle, and I don't want to get into this now, but if you're interested in it, I'd be happy to explain to you some of those passages that I think have lost their meaning and have had a different intent at the time. So here we have a message from human beings a long time ago where we can't even, where we're not even sure of some of the messages. Interesting thought to consider. Thanks.
Okay, well now, yes, Barney, would you like to come in?
I'd like to offer a comment on this rotation prayer that you produced. At the original 1961 SETI conference that was held at Green Bank, the Set Curve, Su Shu Huang was present and offered that as a meaningful criterion for the selection of stars that might have solar systems, the idea being the ones that had the low rotation rates in the primaries had planets around them and lost some of the angular momentum of the planets. That has fallen into discredit, and I'm not the person to tell you exactly why, but the astronomers no longer think that that's a very meaningful criterion. Perhaps it has to do with the fact that even if you suggest that the globule out of which a star forms is only partaking of the rotation of the galaxy itself, it will end up with something like 100 times or 200 times the angular momentum of an entire planetary system. It has to shed a lot more angular momentum than just its planets in the process of forming a star. And so whether it has planets or not is not very consequential.
Other comments? Yes.
Well, I was inspired by some of your opening remarks to ask a question a few minutes ago. And so this is going back to what I'd intended to ask then. And it's it arises because it's occurred to me that it's been quite an event here in the past couple of days, and we have quite a distinguished panel of experts. And since this is being recorded, I thought no better time than to just conduct a tiny thought experiment here and ask a simple question. And I don't know if you want to do this, but here's the question. I thought we might take, as an audience, so to speak, a poll of the panel and say to you, well, just imagine that by the end of this century, we do have a successful detection. Let's leave the decoding debates and problems and controversy aside and quickly poll the panel, if you wish, for your opinions on whether you think there will be a significant impact. And I have in mind the following possibility. I've come across a number of people in the past who've thought that the discovery of the existence of ETI will be rather like the moon landings, a sort of five-minute wonder. It'll capture the imagination of the Earth's population for a short time, and then it will fade. I personally don't think that that will be the case. But my question is, what do the panel think? Is that okay to...
Sure,
I think for the record, given the nature of this event...
It might be worthwhile to poll the whole audience. It's an easy thing to do if people don't mind voting in public.
Do it both ways. Have expert opinion.
We can simply say,
and
let's propose that those people who think this will have an important and lasting impact versus those who think it'll be interesting but not all that important in the long run, that the question you want to ask?
Well, I personally would especially like to hear a very quick comment from each member of the panel. I think it could be done in a minute or two. Have an opinion from the masses out here.
Oh, you want a comment from the panel? Well, would anyone like to comment?
What do you think?
Well, I think if you want to poll the audience, you better do it now before the panel speaks.
All right. Well, let's try that. Let's see among the audience. So I'll ask you in a moment to hold up your hand if you think that this really will have an impact on our thinking and a more or less permanent impact, versus the fact that it'll hit the news, the headlines, and then after a while, it won't make any difference to anybody. So those who think it will have an impact, please hold up your hands. Okay, and those who don't think it might have that much of an impact, okay, well, it's a pretty pretty high ratio that people think it'll have an impact. In between? Well, of course, there are all gradations, and I don't think we can play it that finely, but do you have a particular comment to make?
I was just going to say, obviously, to answer a question like this is simply a guess. It certainly depends upon the nature of what this contact or discovery of contact is, how close it might be, and a bunch of other parameters. On one hand, people will hear such a thing, and there will be an immediate impact. We'll go through the press, and then people will go back to their daily business. But there will be a slow gradation of effect that works its way through society. So there could be a lasting impact. It could take a very long time, depending on just how imminent such a contact would be. If it is clear that something's going to happen real fast, we made contact, something is going to be coming real fast, whatever it might be, then there's going to be a very fast diffusion through the society of what happens. If it's just a contact that occurs, we say, well, for 5 minutes we had a contact and it hasn't happened for 10 years, people will forget it.
Well, let's take time now to just go quickly through the panel up here and see who would like to make a comment about how they see this. Barney?
Well, I think that the discovery would produce an immediate flash of sensation, first of all, that would die away quickly. In my estimate, that would be a matter of a few weeks and the NFL would take over again on Monday night. On the other hand, I think there would be, in addition to that, a slow infiltration of the deeper levels of the structure of our society with the information that accrues over a long time scale, and I mean by that centuries. The males may be slow, but the integrated effect of continuing transmission and learning about life on a broader scale will necessarily have an immense philosophic impact upon the human race. But that's not going to be something that happens in my lifetime or yours. It's going to be something that would happen as we all mature, as our species matures.
Anyone else like to make a comment?
Go ahead. Yeah, I'd just like to harken back to what Arthur C. Clarke said this morning. When Columbus went back home, was there a big hoopla? Probably not, but he certainly had an impact on the thinking of the civilized world. And that's essentially saying what Barney said, but I like that little image of Columbus going back home and hooray, it's all over, so what?
I'm afraid that television has done a disservice to the public in desensitizing the public to this. The Star Trek is so popular. So if this were to come out, there would be a big yawn. Ha ha, well, we knew all this, you know. I'm afraid that kind of impact I get from some of my students, even if I read them correctly, there's too much of this on television. And I think they've done a disservice. Will it have an impact? I think it'll be very controversial because nobody wants to let somebody else get away with a big discovery like this. The scientists would immediately say, "Wow, this isn't it. This was spurious," and so forth. So I assume, I'm going to put myself on record here, it'll be a controversy for a long time.
Anyone else want to make a comment? Okay.
First of all, I agree totally with Barney's comments. As long as the data rate is slow, it's going to take a long, long time, and the first impact will disappear very quickly. But if the data rate happens to be with lots of information coming in quickly, that is in which the information is something that really makes a important difference to us. Then after the initial die down, something important can happen in a couple years. But that's highly unlikely. I more think that it'll be a lower data rate and it will take a long integrated time for something significant to result from it.
I'd just like to say that I believe that what we're currently doing is looking for a needle in a very, very large haystack, and we know not whether there is a needle in the haystack at this point. If someone were to say, yes, there is a needle in the haystack, and it's in this portion of the haystack, or there are multiple needles in there, and these are some of the places where there's a higher concentration of needles, then I think that there will be systems developed that will concentrate on those regions, and the progress that will be made will be much faster. I do believe it will be all over CNN for a while. It will die off. But I think that the national programs that support the scientific research will be stimulated substantially, and there will be a great progress that would be made, a great increase in rate of progress at finding those needles and understanding them.
Could I say something?
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Okay, here's a brief comment first.
Brief comments, sir. I want to surprise everybody and say I agree with Barney. I'm my co-chair.
Well done.
Someone mentioned you'd have to know how close they were, and that raises the prospect that they may be visiting in person, whatever a person is. And I think that is very important. But let's try to separate out two distinct aspects of the problem, the social and political aspects, and even the religious aspects, right, from what I'd like to call the cognitive aspects, the sheer theoretical value of having a confirming instance. There is an X such that X is an extraterrestrial intelligence and has signaled us. Now, if you are looking at the rational decision-making framework for devoting resources to a search, a positive result of which is confirmation of an existential claim, there are things of this kind. The negative result of which is just you do not know whether they exist, they might without your detecting them, on the other hand they might not. Then you have the following problem. Before you engage in the search, and before you even decide whether to undertake the search, you have, on the grounds of other theoretical considerations like cosmology and evolution, biology and so on, a subjective prior probability that you attach to the belief that there are things of this as yet uninstantiated, unexamined, undiscovered kind. Right? Each one of us here could go through a Ramsey test to find out the degree of subjective belief in the claim that there is an extraterrestrial intelligence that might be able to communicate with us. So you have the subjective prior probability. Now, take someone who is so convinced in the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence that that probability for them is one. Then actually discovering it is a kind of ho-hum, I told you so, experience. So for them, the cognitive value of the discovery is more like zero. Now take someone who's extremely skeptical, has a prior probability right down near zero, but then has overwhelming evidence in the form of the discovery that they do after all exist. For that person, the cognitive value is up near one. So you have something like an inverse, and let's just say for the sake of argument, linear relationship between prior subjective probability and the cognitive value of the discovery, should you make it after devoting the resources to it. Now you have to decide how to maximize the expected cognitive utility of the search. The expected cognitive utility of the search will be the proportionality constant V, that's the top cognitive value you can get, times P times 1 minus P. And that peaks for this inverse linear relationship at 0.5, subjective probability of 0.5, at the value V over 4. Okay? It's just a straightforward piece of rational decision theory. The conclusion is inescapable that if you want to maximize the expected cognitive utility of a discovery before you undertake the search, you should be ever so cool about the possible outcome. You should have a completely open mind. And I think that's why it's headquartered in California.
Now, if you put a different function in here, something like the arc of a circle, either convex or concave or something sinusoidal, you get the same qualitative argument. It's just that the value changes from 0.5 to something else in this neighborhood. But you still get this thing that I call a paradox of pure curiosity, that there is some particular subjective prior probability which it is best for you to have in order to be able to maximize the expected cognitive utility of undertaking a search in the first place.
Is that any different to claim that the maximum information, the information received on the average will be a maximum if there's a maximum on safety to begin with?
I beg your pardon? It's a maximum?
If the uncertainty to begin with is a maximum, value is one half.
Right.
And you get the maximum information from confirming or
I guess it's the same.
It's all the same.
Right.
Well, I see one more hand up here.
I don't know if I should. Could I just
quick comment? Sure. Briefly.
I'd had this argument explained to me the other day, actually, Neil, by Don Huben, and something occurred to me in the explanation of the probabilities. He gave the same explanation that you've just given. And the expected cognitive utility is going to be different for the searchers, the SETI experts, as from the lay public at large who know nothing about SETI, because of the fact that so many people outside the field of SETI are so ignorant of what the reality of the science is and are so reluctant to treat SETI or regard it as serious science. So they're going to be resistant to accepting the idea that ETIs might be out there. Therefore, no matter what the utility will be for the searchers, whether at the skeptical end or the less skeptical end of the scale, the expected cognitive utility is going to be very great for the lay people.
Could I say something, just a quick reply to that? It seems to me that there's something which is almost like a pragmatic paradox in the propaganda efforts of the SETI community. I have been to presentations, I was impressed by one by John Billingham, where a lot of cosmological and evolutionary biological facts were presented for the benefit of a lay but educated audience, designed, it seemed to me, rhetorically, massively to increase on the part of the audience the subjective prior probability that they might be prepared to attach to the claim that there exists extraterrestrial intelligence. In other words, they're taking you too far to the right of this hump, thereby lessening the expected cognitive gains. It seems to me rhetorically, if you're being perfectly rational and expect your audience to be perfectly rational, you should try to argue them out of their skepticism only up to the midpoint in the spectrum of probabilities.
We like to go a little farther. We're used to talking to congressmen.
I'm going to take the privilege of saying a few things on this. I enjoy these philosophical arguments, however, what is not contained in that is the importance of the question itself. One could say, well, what's the probability of a $10 bill lying under the table there? And then you say, well, those people who doubt it, it's going to be an enormous finding if it's there. I would say it's relatively unimportant. I think it's the subject matter itself which makes it important. And I would agree, and I would look at it as a kind of a functional thing, and I would agree very much with what Dr. Lesher said, that if it's found, first place, I think there are some reasons for believing that life is really quite rare, but if it's found, there'll be an intense scientific effort, enormous scientific effort. Everybody will jump on trying to see whether it is real, and what can we find out from it, and so on. It'll be a very intense scientific effort. Will it be of any value to us? From the point of view of technology, probably not. But from the point of view of culture and thought, yes, I think in the long run it's going to be very profound, and it will certainly affect the scientific community and a lot of people, I believe, in terms of the search. And as we search, presumably we'll find out something. If it turns out we've got something but we can never find out anything, it'll take 10,000 years or so before we can get there, or they can get to us, or anything else can happen. then it might be slow, yet almost immediately, I suspect, the cultural changes would be there. Well, now, I suggest, rather now continuing this somewhat philosophical discussion, which we can do a little bit later, let's go ahead and have the final three members of our panel say what they would like to say, and then we can round this off more, a little more at our leisure.
You know, I've enjoyed today's discussions. I've heard some very well put arguments and very fascinating descriptions of systems. But I'm going to state an extreme view, which I had sense enough not to write down in my paper, to see what I can stir up here. I'm going to be an extremist and say that if I could do SETI and free space were truly free, I would go for long wavelengths to do it. The reason is that at long wavelengths, the area of an isotropic antenna is bigger. Essentially, you could eventually get to wavelengths that are so long that your isotropic antenna would have lots of collecting area. You could look at all of the directions you wanted. Your Doppler effects and other things that are percentages of frequency go away, and the whole problem is simple. We have small difficulties with that. There's a real plasma in space. But essentially, these arguments have gone back and forth over the years as to whether longer wavelengths or shorter wavelengths are better. I've always been slightly predisposed to wavelengths that are long enough to be usable, but not so long that they're utterly noisy, essentially for these kinds of reasons. And I've noticed often that in this discussion, things have been phrased as if it were a controversy, as if somehow the people who were predisposed to the longer wavelengths were unaware that there could be cogent arguments like high-gain antennas for shorter wavelengths. And I don't think that's really true. On the other hand, I'm not sure that I've heard today arguments that say we must, in fact, for some kind of compelling reason, go to short wavelengths or some particularly good one. I've heard lots of arguments that say that lasers will work across large distances, which clearly are true. And I just wonder how some of the strong advocates of shorter wavelengths feel about this kind of thinking. In other words, do you see strong predisposing reasons to go for optical or near optical wavelengths in searches? And I guess that would be my only comment on this. It's been a fun session.
Okay. We'll move on. Then we'll come back. So
yeah, right.
Okay.
People
comment on
this. People answer if they want.
I think we live in an exciting time because I guess I believe that SETI started some several thousand years ago when people contemplated this guy. I think we have to have this patience we discussed on earlier, and I think we also have to evolve, because I think that no matter what our technology is, we're always going to have, it's really great to be able to sit back and speculate about what might be the best possible way to do it. You can argue about it all day long, and it's good and healthy to do that. But once you go to build the equipment, you got to put money on the table, and you got to build something, and you got to make a lot of limitations, because you can't build something for everybody. And in that process, you try to go along and do the best you can at the time you're doing it, and try to get something started. And that's how I think we got started on the microwave part of the spectrum. I think that it's very important for us to have discussions like this, because I think the next phases, phase SETI 2, SETI 3, SETI 4, may well take us one hell of a long time to make this discovery, because I don't think it's going to be that easy. I don't know. I'd love to have it happen in my lifetime, but who knows? But I think we really are. We're continuing this quest we've been speculating about for thousands of years. We've finally gotten started doing some experiments. Let's keep trying to develop new and better experiments as we go along. And who knows when the detection will be made. But someday I think it really will be made. And somehow in this kind of activity we're having now will be one stepping stone along the way. I hope it's the last stepping stone, but maybe it isn't. Maybe there'll be others to follow. So I think we need to continue to evolve in our thinking. And don't get too wrapped up with arguing about what's exactly the best possible way to do it. Because no matter what we think the best possible way is today, we're probably wrong. We'll change our minds in 10 or 20 years.
Okay, Barney.
Well, I think the audience has heard enough from me by now. let me say that I don't think I could put the case for the
big, warm, fuzzy photon any better than Kent Colliers has.
Okay, now let's open it up to discussion of these last remarks or anything else. Yes, back here.
Doing here today, that we're searching for intelligence extraterrestrially, and from a philosophical point of view, even though I'm a scientist, we really need to, I think, investigate or at least examine what our motivations are to look for intelligence off this planet versus looking for the intelligence, the native intelligence that we have internally, and respond to the quest that's there. I take exception to the expenditure of funds, not from a theoretical point of view, but from a humanitarian point of view, to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence when there are many, many intelligent beings that are on this planet that are suffering, that if any of us were suffering to that degree, we would think it would be ridiculous to expend the kind of money we're talking about in the direction that we're expending it. So I think we all need to be cognizant of tremendous suffering that's going on this planet and question whether there is any intelligence on this planet based on that cognizance.
Other comments?
Charlie, let me respond to that a little bit. There are two comments he's making there. I have to respond to the one about the amount of being expended on SETI, and I want to just emphasize how trivial that amount is. Even if it were orders of magnitude more than it is, it's still a small amount. I've likened it to throwing coins in a wishing well. I mean, we do that without thinking about it, and this is about the same amount of money we're talking about a nickel a year per taxpayer or a dime a year per taxpayer. So don't get upset about that amount.
Other comments? Yeah, just back here.
Yeah, I've got a simple-minded question on the nature of the first communication. It just occurs to me, and it's probably occurred to all of you, that it could be some sort of laser rangefinder for someone actually making a three-dimensional map of the universe, you like, for a road map, perhaps, and maybe to make sure we're included in that map, we should be sorting out a retroreflector of some kind.
Well, let's see, I was in...
Do you want to write a proposal, Jim?
Oh, of course, you
might. Inverse Borg.
I guess it's a question that I'm not sure that whether we can hope to understand other beings. And the statement was made that the laws of physics are universal, hence the laws of chemistry, hence possibly the laws of biology. I guess as a physical scientist, I would agree that nature does obey some sort of rationality. But the laws of physics, as we have them today, as we have ever had them, and as we can ever hope to have them, are approximations. We can never hope to know the final truth about nature. I mean, I'm not sure that I understand what that phrase means in any case. What I'm carrying around to saying is that the laws of physics as we have them today are the result of centuries of intellectual evolution, starting from a particular point and modulated by particular circumstances that surround us. It is not a priori obvious to me that a totally alien civilization would even think about physics in the way that we do. Would they indeed know, speak of electrons? I horrify my students by telling them I regard an electron as being a syndrome, a collection of symptoms. Now that's a fairly heretical view for Western physicists. But it seems to me that they may be discoursing in terms that are simply incomprehensible to us. And while I would certainly go along with this defense of looking for extraterrestrial signals, and I think it would have a profound impact to know that we are not alone, what we could hope to learn from them I'm not at all certain.
Well, I don't. I don't see an immediate response, but let me comment on that a little. First, of course, we would learn that there's someone there. And that's not unimportant to us. I think the importance of our ideas and our culture is frequently brushed aside. Why do we pay so much money for music? What good is music doing us? Well, it's a cultural phenomenon. We enjoy it. We think it's important. So are ideas. I think you're quite right that an alien civilization might not even quite have the concept of electron the way we do. On the other hand, if we believe that the nature of the universe is in fact universal, and we have really pretty good tests of that, they do something and they're going to see a reaction just as we do the same thing, see the same reaction. So they may describe electrons in terms of waves. They might have started out looking at them as waves, as we do too. They may have a different kind of explanation, but the phenomenon they will be describing will be essentially the same. If they have, in fact, some new phenomenon, that would be fantastic. And we'll learn a lot from that. So that I think that if, in fact, we could find such a civilization and communicate, intellectual growth would be tremendous.
The communication is presupposing a lot, because it presupposes that you're at least have the same intellectual concepts. Language in the most general sense. My point is that we have arrived at the concept of the electron because our history and our evolution causes us to poke nature, call it, in certain ways. And nature then showed us something which we called an electron. If you have grown up in a culture where you do not do those sorts of poking, where I can't describe such as culture because I've grown up in the Western culture, and so I'm based on mathematics and physics, etc., etc. But it seems to me not inconceivable that another civilization will not have interrogated nature in the way that we have done, but may have interrogated in very different ways, and therefore they may have technological capabilities which we are insensitive to, but also we may simply not be capable of communicating. But I take your point, and it's a matter of
Charlie, let me respond a little bit.
Yeah.
These things may give scientists and philosophers a lot of trouble. They don't give engineers much trouble. And the reason is that you prove your concept, either the gadget works or it doesn't work. And I would expect that the aliens' power plants wouldn't look very different from ours, because they have to be based upon principles that we both commonly understand. So it's that body of knowledge, proof that you get something and it functions or it doesn't function, that tells you whether you're on the right track or not.
Well, I guess maybe I'm enough of an engineer to agree with you in part, and I would say, okay, so they're not poking something. They are interacting with the world around them, as we are. So they are finding out some things. They are interacting. Otherwise they can't signal us. They must be interacting with the universe, and hence they are sampling some of the same things we are sampling, maybe in a different way. And nevertheless, it will be common knowledge in my view. Okay.
Let me just apologize for asking so many questions from the audience. I never intended to do that. But there was one thing that was said back here a few minutes ago that it's something that's always been very much on my mind, and I felt I just had to respond to it, so please bear with me. This concerned the general justification for doing SETI. You had said that it's really not that much of a cost in real terms, or relatively speaking. I agree with that, but I think that there's a much more effective response to the kind of view that was expressed earlier back here, the negative views on SETI, just doing SETI per se. That is, and it connects with the question that I thought was a good question for the panel. What do you think the impact would be of the certain the discovery of certain existence of ETI? And I think that, contrary to what I heard being expressed from panel members, that the impact of the discovery of ETI will be very profound indeed, because it will remove, it will rob certain myths, certain strong anthropocentric myths, and I'm thinking here especially of certain religious myths, of the logical possibilities that they see themselves as having right now for justifying their worldview. Once we know that ETI is out there, then certain kinds of justifications will no longer be available. There won't be something that you can put into the public marketplace and persuade people of. Consequently, one then can say, well, look, given the damage that a lot of religious outlooks and worldviews have had, have inflicted on populations over time, one can go back in history and find reasons for making good that claim, then I think one can say, look, here's a good reason for doing SETI. Maybe we'll increase, if we discover the existence of ETI, our sense of vulnerability as a species, make us more cautious about preserving the environment, make us more cautious about managing our resources and how we cautious in our dealings with each other. So I think that's a fairly forceful response that can be given to somebody who says, why should we do SETI? We're spending a lot of money and wasting it. And I'll shut down.
Okay, Fred.
I'd like to respond to that a little bit, if I may. I'm a strong believer in serendipity, and that's why I think the SETI project is an excellent one. Astronomers until 20 years ago have only looked at static signals. It was photographic plates. Now they're looking in the time domain. I think it's long overdue that is a field which should be explored, and I'm willing to put money on this. They're going to discover something. Something in this technique will make discoveries. I don't know what, but serendipity always worked. You're looking for the Loch Moh monster. I never found the monster, but boy, did they make big discoveries. I think they will make discoveries.
Yes, back here.
What I was saying is negative. I'm just saying that the desire to find intelligence is honorable and good, but there's plenty of intelligence on this planet. Why? It's like I say to my wife, who might be into astrology, why look for magic that's not verifiable when there's all this miraculous science that exists on this planet? Why look for intelligence outside of this planet when there's tremendous intelligence and many different species of life on this planet that requires substantial investigation? I'm not saying we shouldn't do SETI. I'm just saying that the same desire and heart that goes to SETI ought to also go to people who you pass on the street who obviously need something as well.
I suspect
same
most
kind of thing, not different.
Okay, I think that's a point. I think most of us would say, yes, we should do that, but we should do all of it. We should do all of it, and it's a kind of a matter of taste and place and so on as to what individuals happen to be doing. But I don't think anybody would downplay the importance of what you're saying.
Perhaps the whole community is misnamed. There's a division here between what the engineers and scientists can do and the interpretation of communications or what it might mean. Perhaps what we really have is a search for extraterrestrial technology or a search for extraterrestrial engineering. And we can all have fun and talk about the intelligence behind it and whether we can interpret it or not. But in fact, with the engineering comment in mind, it's only the engineering and the technology that we can really search for.
Nick, you've nailed it exactly right. And that's why that's really what's behind SETI, S-E-T-I. Somebody mentioned it earlier. S-E-T-I is looking for, in my view, looking for signs of extraterrestrial technology. Now, SETI, how do you pronounce it, Barney?
SETI
with a C, a Cyrillic C, then gets into communication. And that's when you get all the philosophers and everybody else involved. And those of us who are engineers and technologists will maybe not be participating so much. It'll be a whole different audience. So I think in fact, that's, you put your finger right on it. I wanted to address just for a minute, too, the idea that we should be helping our fellow human. I want to say that I have some expertise in engineering and technology. I know how to take those tools and apply them to a problem which I think most people in this room think is an important one. But I'm also applying not my tools, because I don't know how to take radio telescopes or detectors or optical mirrors and help the poor person in the street. But I do that all the time because I happen to contribute a great deal of my money to help support those people, or to help not support them so much as I particularly like to give them to groups that offer them ways out of their morass rather than just handing them a handout. So I think we have to do all of these things, and we do, and we take the tools that we know how to use and put them to the best use. So you're not going to get a physicist or an astronomer turning his or her radio telescope or optical telescope to help support somebody who's starving in the street. So I that's my answer to that. I am contributing to it, and I can show you the checks I write.
Could I say something about why we should study other intelligences besides our own? Suppose you had that attitude towards the study of your society at a different time. Why should we want to know anything about this society 100 years ago? It's this society now we want to know something about. Then you'd lose all the value of history and the wisdom that comes from that. If you applied that to the study of societies in other places, you'd lose all the wisdom of anthropology and how it reflects on your own society and the provinciality of your own circumstances. If you had that attitude towards the study of other natural languages besides English, you'd miss out on the prospect of principles of universal grammar and enlightenment as to the basic cognitive operations of the human mind. And you could just multiply this over and over. You should never limit your attention cognitively to any particular provincial instances of what you hope is a natural kind, be it a human society or a racial group or a species. Like, you know, don't study slime molds. Human beings are far more interesting. Why study slime molds? Or don't study haplodiploid species. We've got enough problems with the diploid ones. I mean, I just don't see the force of the argument.
Well, let me see if I can say something controversial. I would make 2 points. I think overall that the higher frequencies are probably somewhat better and more powerful for SETI. And I would pick for those higher frequencies, I would pick something in the somewhere in the infrared region as a compromise between the amount of background noise and the size of the quanta and so on. But in any case, somewhat higher frequencies I think are somewhat more favorable. Now, I don't think one can be completely convincing in either direction, but that's my own conviction. And I believe the reason we're doing SETI in the microwave region now is a historical matter of how our technology happens to lie at the moment. I'm all in favor of it. I think we should do it there because I don't think it's so obvious what another civilization would pick. On the other hand, from the fundamental point of view, I think the shorter wavelengths are really somewhat more favorable. Now, the second controversial thing I would say is that I don't think the discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence will have very much effect on religion. That's been brought up a few times, and the reason for mentioning it, I just call to your attention the effect of Galileo on religion. That had a very strong effect for a while. It changed religion some, but Pope John Paul II has been, in the last decade, expressed himself many times with apologies to Galileo, and science is just fine, and Galileo was right, and so on. And the Catholic religion has been modified, and all religions have probably been modified some, but nevertheless, they're here and have much the same characteristics. So while I think it could shake up religion, I don't think it would change it very basically. Anybody want to argue with that or comment on other matters? Okay.
I would like to make a few comments which are not directly related to that. But earlier we had been talking about what would be the impact of the detection of ETI signals on society. And I had
commented that there would be a brief interest followed by perhaps a slow diffusion. It would depend on really how much information, how imminent the signal seemed to be. And I was pleased to see some of the experts echoed what I had said. One thing that I didn't get to say was, and this goes to your comments about myths and stuff, it will have an impact on society by way of the subject that comes to you in a plain brown wrapper. I refer, of course, to UFOs. Now, there is presently a saturation of some level going on in society, even as we speak, on the subject. Roper poll, or rather, polls over the years have shown a belief on the order of 50% of the population thinks, quote, UFOs are real, unquote, whatever that means. And detection, aside from whether scientists argue among themselves on the validity of the detection, if someone were to go public and say, we detected extraterrestrial life, maybe weeks, days, months, or years later, it will be proven that the detection was wrong. But if that were to happen, I think that one effect would be legitimizing UFO sightings. Now, of course, from the scientific point of view, there would be no connection. But in the public's mind, and the public is awfully much affected by the entertainment industry and by reporters and so on who are, shall we say, less than critical, you would see this pop up in the tabloids as proof that UFO sightings represent ETs that have been coming here for years or whatever, and you see all sorts of theorizing about it. Well, the point that I'm making is this is something that hasn't been brought up. But one of the things that's going to, one impact on society will be the legitimization of, to some extent, of the UFO phenomenon, at least in the minds of the lay people.
We shouldn't do it. Well, okay, one last comment here. Go ahead.
I feel I have to respond to what you said about religion.
Good.
Very briefly. Here's one way in which there won't be an impact on religion from the discovery, certain discovery of ETI. From the psychologist and sociologist point of view, people will continue to be religious if that means that they use vague language to describe something called religious experience, or experiences which for them are counted by them as religious experiences. That's a way in which, and one amongst a number of ways in which religion won't be affected. Here's a way in which religion will be affected. It will be affected to the extent that you have an explanation about existences, namely how this whole show of ours came to be here, couched in terms of there being a creator who has properties which are rather like ours, only a perfect reflection of the properties that we have. So this idea of a God who's omniscient, omnibenevolent, omnipotent, and who's modeled us in his image, I think will be blown to smithereens forever and always, and a good thing too, by the discovery of ETIs, who perhaps, if we can solve the decoding problem, will be discovered to have a biological morphology unimaginably different from ours. That's the way in which religion will be profoundly shaken.
Okay, we are modeled in his image in what sense?
Well, according to certain myths, he's sort of got human-like qualities, but they're rather, they're perfect.
You mean he looks like us or something like that, you know, that's...
Gray, perhaps.
Wears a big white frilly frock, and...
I think it would be only that kind of sense that will change some.
Wouldn't it blow you away if all of a sudden you found out from that decoding that you worked on so diligently that the God that people talk about, in fact, is not anthropocentric and doesn't look like us or think like us? But my God, they've got one too, and there's a lot that matches. What would you do with that one?
Well, then I'd turn to the anthropologists, the anthropological experts, and say, you know, how, we could probably, some biologists too, we'd have some interesting
The thing to say is that you couldn't get better evidence of bad translation.
Keep an open mind, my friend.
All right, well, maybe we've come to an end. Would our leader like to say anything in closing?
I just wanted to thank all the panel and speakers and the audience for interesting and stimulating discussion. I want to point out that the kind of talks that we had here the last 2 days are so different from the ordinary SPIE engineering conferences that it was to those like myself, we greatly enjoyed it and felt it was a real advantage to be here and listen to everybody. Thank you.
I just want to make one comment. Even if you discover the extraterrestrial intelligence, what makes you think that it is God that is there?
What?
And you will infect the religion.
I
just heard the comments that the presence of the ETI automatically equates to the presence of God. That's not necessarily so.
What?
I'm not sure we all understood that.
I don't think we understood it at all.
What, would you say that again, briefly?
If you discover the presence of the ETI, somebody is suggesting that it will be automatically equated to the existence of God.
No. Nobody said that.
No.
Oh, okay. Then that's fine.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, actually, just before I close, I'm just wondering whether people feel we should have another one of these in a year or so, Obstacle SETI 2. You know, I don't know whether we can make it bigger and better.
When we get signals.
Certainly, we want to avoid meeting on a Friday. That's not a good day. But we tell you earlier in the week, I'd certainly like to thank all our speakers in this conference for their participation. I'm particularly grateful for Barney. Even though we may not see eye to eye, I'm very grateful that he did join us and all the speakers. I don't know. We've been talking generally here and on various aspects. I don't suppose any of us have changed our minds about the efficacies of different approaches to SETI in the last day and a half. I suppose this will come in time. I'm interested, in fact, to sort of get the word out and let more people consider these topics, and especially people with a scientific interest, keep an open mind, be prepared to consider other people's views, and perhaps this could become somewhat of a unifying a sort of scientific theme, I think, in human society. I think it's quite it's a great stimulus for young people. If you're thinking, especially in this country, talking about the sort of collapse of sort of the educational system and the understanding of the sciences, and Barney mentioned this earlier, that go out to the school systems and talking about this, and because there are far more people around would actually have optical telescopes and don't have to have dishes in their backyard, that just me coming along and making a little bit noise here, perhaps the optical approach has merit, might actually help microwave SETI, because I'm not down on that, and I think that if more people consider the topic, there will be in time, as we develop a consensus bottom up, so the information gradually flows up to members of Congress, the people who've got the purse strings, that there will be more funding available for microwave SETI and professional optical SETI. At that point, I'd like to conclude these proceedings, and again, thank everyone for coming. Thank you.
Thank you for raising your arm.